It's very nice to be here. I'll discuss indeed more on modeling folding kinetics and the minor title is Decoding RNA Folding Path. So I'll try to convince you that folding pathways can really be encoded on the RNA sequence. So that will be this result part of the talk. And then I'll try also to save some time to show you that we can now think of doing the sort of reverse engineering sort of approach. We can think of encoding folding pathways on sequence we obviously want to create from scratch and try to have artificial RNA molecules doing interesting or unusual things while they actually fold. So Terry suggested to me that in order to cover especially the last two parts, I go maybe a bit faster on the beginning. Well, the beginning I will simply skip because you all know the main thing. So I will talk a little bit on RNA signalized structures because of pseudonauts. So I'll say a little bit more on that. And then on the prediction method I use, so how can we model a folding path, so RNA folding kinetics. So I'll try to do that in a fairly fast way during the first part of this talk, and maybe after tea break we can go back and talk about the details, because obviously some of you might want to know the details. Okay, so just a quick reminder. So RNA signalized structures, well, they come from the folding of those molecules. So as you can see, and as you know, those molecules are apparently very simple. They're just single stranded biopolymers that have a polarity, though I'll come back to that later in the talk. And those polymers are made of only four different bases. But of course, the complexity come into the folding of those objects, that because they are single-stranded, they cannot bind to the exact mirror image as in double-stranded DNA. So instead, what those molecules do is they try to find partially or small complementary regions in their own sequence, and then they collapse and form internal helices. So for instance, as illustrated here. So what you notice, so this is 16S, we already talked about this molecule before. So as you can see, at the level of the signalized structure, you can clearly see domains that really look like trees. So those domains, the internal helices are connected by simple loops that one can look as defect in the sequence, in the structure. And those simple loops are obviously all topologically independent. So the orientation of these different stems are all independent. But if you look more closely, from time to time, you also have hybridization between different branches of this tree. So for instance, if you have two branches like this, if you hybridize between those two loops, you form something which is slightly more topologically complex, where the orientation now of several stems are clearly connected via those single strands parts. And this, of course, as you know, is usually called pseudonauts. So they usually aren't real knots. That is, if you, for instance, grab the ends of this molecule and you pull on it, as Professor Tinoco described earlier, well, usually you can really undo everything. There is no knot on the structure. So this pseudo knot problem is really at the level of the orientation correlation between those helices. Okay, so how can one model RNA singularized structures? So in general, when you start from this linear sequence and it folds, well, in general, you have to expect some real mess where all the helices are connected together by short single-strand pieces. And okay, so now really what you want is to be able to compare different structures for a given sequence, say, or also different structures for different sequences. You really want to try to make comparisons between structures. So obviously, as physicists, what you really want to have is this an evaluation of the free energy of those structures. So as we heard many times earlier, basically the free energy of such a molecule can be decomposed into two different parts. So there is the free energy of stacking of the stems, which is which we can usually model reasonably well with the nearest neighbor model, where you, although you have to take into account the stacking between consecutive base pairs on the stem. So for instance, with these four base pair stems, you really have to take into account at least three stacking numbers, and you actually have also to account for the terminal mismatches. Okay, so now we, as you all, probably most of you know, we have large tables that have been measured mostly in the Turner group, and those numbers are associated with the stacking of consecutive base pairs like this. So we can use these numbers to come up with an estimate of the free energy of each of these individual stems. So that's this part, and that's when you all use the same numbers. So you know those pretty well. So that's that part. But now, as we said just a second ago, well, you also have some other constraint. I mean, this molecule is not made of stems only. You also have these single-strand pieces. and the fact is, when you correlate the orientation of all these stems, basically you have to pay a price on the entropic state of all these single strands in space. So this somehow has to be accounted for. So in a very crude first approach, what we can do to model RNA singularized structures with pseudonauts is to crudely describe such a complex structure as a mixed assembly of stiff rods in blue here, representing the helices, and ideal springs in black here, corresponding to the single strands. And at this level, which is obviously very crude, we can now come up with an estimate of the topological free energy, but really entropy, of this mixed assembly. So as you can guess, when you look at tree-like structures, so the usual structures that all of you know very well, because now the orientation of all these helices are disconnected, you expect that the thermodynamic weight of the global structure can be simply decomposed into independent factors. So that would be the free energy corresponding for the first helix and the second helix, and they are the cost of these loops. So if you describe the single strand like Gaussian polymers, you expect some factor like this for the loops. That's all simple. Now, obviously, if you allow pseudo knots in the structure, the orientation of all these stems will be correlated. And for instance, for these well-known pseudo knots, where you have two stems connected by three springs, you can, in fact, at this level of rods and ideal springs, you can, in fact, estimate the free energy costs of this assembly. And okay, and when you do the calculation, you just obtain a formula where obviously you can see that now the helices have cross terms, and the factor of these cross terms involve the combination of all these three springs connecting the two stems. Still, you can obviously recognize that we're dealing with Gaussians, which obviously is a reminder that all these chains are L1, L2, the length of those stems, of the connected stems. So here we have an object that has five parameters, the length of these two stems. So obviously you have to account for the helix pitch and all this, and the length of these springs, in which you have to account for the persistent length. So you basically have five parameters, and here is the formula with those five parameters. So you can now see that you retrieve the obvious limits when you, for instance, push S1 to infinity or to zero, and you because this is general, you just cover basically all possible pseudo-knots that have this topology. But of course, this is only one pseudo-knot, and in principle, you'd like to do it for a much more complex structure like this. So this, in fact, I won't describe right now, and I will leave for the discussion on and the more detailed part after the tea break.
The S value is the entropy. Are those computed, or?
Sorry, what?
S1, S2,
S3. Yes. So you just look at the structure, okay? And for instance, here you see, well, there is five free bases, okay? So five free bases is not exactly S1 equal 5, because you have to divide by the persistent length. So here that might be 3, say. So the effective S1 would be 3, roughly. I mean, you have to put numbers, but that's the picture. Okay? okay, so again, I won't detail more right now, but you'll have more details after tea break. okay, so... Okay, in the second part, I will just quickly remind you what is the basic RNA folding problem, and I won't hardly say anything about the traditional algorithms that have been covered several times already. Then I will move to the main part, really, of this talk that covered modeling of RNA folding pathways, so RNA folding kinetics. Okay, so the first question that we'd like to address is whether it is at all reasonable to expect to be able to predict those structures. So the first thing that you can do, and that I actually do in the actual code, when you take a sequence, well, you first enumerate all possible stems that can be formed on this sequence. So here is an example, 76 nucleotides from a tRNA. And on each line here, I have put a different stem. So that these two lines means that ACCA can pair with UGGU, okay? And then I move the frame over the whole sequence. So here I've listed all helices that are longer than four nucleotides. And you see that it already for 76 nucleotides, you have more than 40 helices that are longer than four nucleotides. Obviously, there are others that are other helices that are shorter, so typically three nucleotides is still, might still be a stable helix. But if I had put those on the transparencies, I mean, they would completely fill it. And I think there are more than 100 helices longer than three nucleotides. Okay, so that's the basic problem. Obviously, now what we want is really we want to find the combination of those stems, of those helices that are formed in the native structure. So here, for instance, for the tRNA, we really want to find a way to pick up the blue stems. And I won't discuss this more, but this is obviously not a trivial problem. So as you know, the usual approach is to try to, given the parameter set that we have, try to find the absolute minimum over all those structures. But that can only be done really efficiently for those tree-like structures, because you have these recursive algorithms that allows you to cover extensively all this structure space when you limit yourself to these nested structures. Okay, so I won't say more about that. Obviously, now there are, and this is very convenient. Now there are on online sites where you can really test any sort of sequence you have, and that will give you a good set of very low free energy structures that look like that. I added one extra overnight where you can actually pull on the ends of this molecule. So, okay. So, but again, if you want to add pseudonauts, you can't really do. Exhaustively search the structure space, because this is too large and there is no way to explore this space efficiently. I mean, in general, this is exponential. There have been attempts to do it when you limit yourself to a given set of pseudonauts, you can do things. And in fact, there is a group, AD's group, who proposed a recursive algorithm, including sudden pseudonauts, which scale as n to the 6. So n to the 6 is obviously much more costly than n to the 3rd. But in fact, the main problem that I see is that the bottom line is, with n to the 6, you can't really try, you can't explore structure space for longer than more than 130 bases. And really, below those lengths, you don't expect to have much pseudonauts at all. So really, you know, that's that. For longer structures, where obviously you expect to have more pseudonauts, there is no good recursive algorithm that can do that. Okay, so the alternative could be to try to follow the folding process itself. So we're now giving up on exploring exhaustively phase space. Okay, that's too difficult, we can't do that. But maybe there is a reasonable way to try to model the folding path of those molecules in this gigantic phase space. So, okay, so that's basically a hope, but I think this is well supported by experimental results. So those results, in fact, I mean, the folding kinetics of RNA, as was already said earlier, is something very well known for 30 years, maybe. So we really now have good time estimate for the formation of stems and dissociation of stems. So here, I was actually inspired by a more recent experiment that was done in Liebschaber's group in Rockefeller, where I did part of my postdoc. So in those experiments, you look at a small molecule. So it's actually a single-stranded DNA that they look at. So this small molecule has been engineered so that the ends can pair, and you have a relatively inert spacer in between. So this molecule has effectively two states, open and closed like this. But what you can do is you can really monitor the fluctuations between those two states. So you can measure the time scale to close the loop or to open it. And to do that, as you probably most of you know, they graph fluorophore and a quencher at the end of this molecule. So when the molecule is in its open state, it fluoresces, whereas when it's closed, the radiation is actually the excitation is not radiated, but instead transferred to the quencher. Okay, so the result of those experiments, which are in agreement with much older measurements by temperature jumps, say the following. And this is very surprising. When you look at the time scale to close this single strand, in fact, this is much longer than the typical collision time of the single strand in the solution. That means that most collision of the single strand in the solution don't lead to the nucleation of the stem. The physical reason behind that is that most collision happens with a wrong orientation of the bases. So you don't have a pre-aligned nucleus that allows you to form to zip along the whole stem. So this means that, yes? Well, I don't remember by heart like this, but it's...
In case this is A and U, then...
It has to be longer, it has to be... Yes.
The first three wouldn't be stable, so they would open more frequently.
Yes. Right.
Only four base pairs. This is sigma pairs. Only four base
pairs
gives you the first stable nucleus.
Yeah, exactly. So in fact, they didn't use only AU... bases, but there was at least half of them were GCs, and I think the stems they used here were five bases long. Just yes. Excuse me. Yes. So if you have duplexes, do they hybridize in solution? Well, again, I mean, it depends the concentration of those species and the length, the stability. Well, I mean, here we have two complementary strands, but they are tethered together by this inert linker. So, I mean, the concentration here doesn't really... I mean, the overall concentration of this beacon doesn't really matter. In fact, they actually look at single molecules. Yes.
Whether they will form a sort of a pair structure, or you need really several of them.
Oh, yes, yes. You need several of them. That was what Peter Schuster...
Three or four, or?
Well, it depends on the sequence. So for AU-rich region, there will be at least four. But for GCs, you can have two even. If you have GC, CG is very stable. No, no, no. I mean, on this experiment, there was single-stranded DNA.
DNA.
Yeah, there was single-stranded DNA. Okay. But the assumption is that for RNA, it should, I mean, the overall picture should be roughly the same, but I think it has never been done. But the duplexes 30 years ago were done on RNA, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If I go a longer loop length, eventually it won't be this local length, right? It will be
okay.
Back to the collision time.
Okay.
How long a loop do you think I have to go to?
Okay, so that's a very good point. Very long. I forgot the actual number, but it's very long. So basically, I'll come to that in a second. What we want to do now is to say, well, I'll come to the point in 2 minutes. When we want to model this or interpret the results of those experiments, what we can straightforwardly do is to say that the rates to form this stem can be really written as the product of an equilibrium term that says that you are at some barrier where the complementary bases are in some close vicinity. So that's equilibrium. That's an equilibrium quantity, because again we are at time scale longer than the diffusion of this object in the solvent. But this probability to be on top of such a conformation, you have to multiply by some local rates that basically corresponds to the time you have to wait for those guys to align if you're holding the single strand in some close vicinity. So, I mean, that's only straightforward interpretation of those experiments. But now the idea is, well, although those experiments have been done in very simple molecules, there is a good chance that the folding of much larger sequences can be modeled with the same sort of kinetic rules. So this is exactly what I've done. So again, I come back to your point. If you look at very long sequences, you expect to retrieve the diffusion-limited picture. So that is, you have to wait for this certain part of the molecule to find themselves in solution. But that corresponds to very large structures, and there is longer than 1,000 bases. That was roughly my estimate. And what I could conclude at that time, that I will never be able to fold as close as 1,000 bases. So in the regime where I can hope to do something, I'm safe, okay? Okay, so the scenario that we want to do in the code is the following. So first you take the sequence, so that's the sequence. What you first do is you first find all possible stems that can potentially be formed in the sequence. So that was the first step I was describing earlier on. Now for each of those stems, you can evaluate a rate with the simple phenomenological kinetics I just described. So we really have to calculate all rates corresponding for all those different stems. Now what you do is, first you can order those rates. So what the usual picture is, you have one rate which is much bigger than the other ones, and then the second one which is already much smaller, etc. And very rapidly, although you have many possible stems, as we saw, you have in fact a very small amount of transitions that cover most of the transition you're likely to choose stochastically. So in fact, that's exactly what we do. We just sum up all those rates, and then we choose the transition at random in proportion to what's its rate. And so this is the total number of transition per unit time in the algorithm. So the inverse of that is the typical resiliency time of this particular conformation. This is the mean time you have to wait until you choose to go somewhere else. Okay?
So you don't count misfold.
Sorry, what?
Misfold?
Yeah. Oh, you do.
The final state is like that, but
okay. So okay, so there is no finite state in this. You're just wandering around phase space, and you can look at average quantities, and you when you're bored or when the no, you don't enumerate anything. You're just following your dynamical system over this complex and overall gigantic phase space that you have no idea how to explore exhaustively. You're just wandering around. But the assumption is that real RNA molecules do exactly the same. I mean, they don't try to explore everything.
So when you have formed one stem, then you do the same procedure for the remaining.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. No. This is not what I do. So what I do is the following. For instance, if I start from this completely denatured sequence, so I have this list of stem, I calculate all rays like that, and I choose the next transition the way I just described. So for instance, here, we choose to make this stem here, okay? So we've compared all the different barriers from here, and we choose this one. We just chose this one. So now we just go down to a new conformation, which is this one, okay? And now that you're here, well, basically, you have to do everything again. So you have to look at your stem list, evaluate all rates. So on those rates, the structure dependency is buried in this equilibrium part, which obviously depend on the structure. But and the prefactor, which I remind you corresponds to a local the local orientation of the bases. Well, we just assume that that should not depend on the overall structure. Obviously, it could depend on the actual sequence locally, but these we don't really have numbers to put in. So I just take from those experiments and from the earlier measurements on RNA, I just take one number for the actual rates. But obviously, this will be a constant in my code. Yes? Yes. Okay. So when I'm in 2, again, I have to do everything again. So I have to look at my list and calculate all the barriers because in general, and there are exceptions, but in general, they have changed because this factor, which depends on the current structure, has changed. Okay? So I mean, in this case, it hasn't changed because we can see that the local region involved to form this stem, well, you know, has not been changed by the former pairing. So in that case, that's an exception. But in general, the rates for each new at the all rates at each new conformation have changed. Okay, so I'll come back to that. I think it will become clearer in a second. So you see, I have this. Basically, what you first do is you discretize structure space, and so, and you have a neighboring relation between certain structures, and this relation corresponds to the addition or the dissociation of one single stem. Okay. So that's the rates we're calculating. So obviously you could, in principle, you could jump from 1 to 3, say. I mean, that's unrealistic, but okay, imagine you have 2 structures, but those 2 structures, they are not neighbors. I mean, the rates to go from here to here is 0, okay? I mean, in the model. So that means that you really have to do something else. So basically you have to either go from in this structure that is nucleating this long stem first or nucleating the other. Okay? So here what I do is I just choose basically one stochastic scenario I just follow one realization of a folding path. Okay? So that's all the information you have. Really, if you want to have more global information, and I'll show you that this is very important, you really have to do that many times. So you have to start from the initial condition that might be open, completely denatured like this, and you have to do this folding scenario many times. And then only you can say, well, okay, if you arrive at all different, very different corners of phase space, after a long running time, well, okay, that means that probably your molecule is not a good folder, or at least, or that your code is missing something. But if all those different scenarios have common features, well, you might start to think there is something in the model. Yes.
The interactions that you have in this, you have just loop entropy and the base pairing, essentially.
So base pairing I describe, loop entropy and pseudo nodes, but at the same level of this loop entropy.
That's basically just loop entropy and base pairing. I'm wondering, so for instance, any type of cooperativity, or one part between contact to another part, I can imagine through tertiary contact intermediaries in terms of influencing secondary structure formation, I'm thinking of electrostatic interactions and things like that, how valid is it to ignore those types of things in terms of this kinetic scheme?
Right. So this I don't know. I mean, the only thing I know is that I think what is interesting here is that precisely what's in the model, in the code, and you can run it. And then you can compare with experiments where that maybe some other interactions might be important. I mean,
that's a reason why you could say, well, gee, at high solar concentrations, we would expect electrostatic to be here on the local loop.
Well, I mean, this is directly, measured from experiments where you presumably have electrostatics as well. I mean, this is a very simple molecule, very simple example, but you already have many. I mean, that's a real molecule. So doesn't mean that for more complex structure you can't have other more complex catenary interaction that might alter those rates. That's possible, but that's certainly not in the model at the level at which. So the base pairing certainly, the K0 is experimental, okay, and this is modeled, okay. So this part, which is equilibrium, this is the model, okay. But the hope is that by merely calculating equilibrium quantities, we can say something about the kinetics of this thing. Yes.
Correctly, in essence, you are doing the same thing that I was proposing in my talk, what we did, except that you are looking on whole stacks, and you have an additional entropy measure for long loops.
Yes.
For the small loops, in order to answer your question, the entropies are in the loop parameters. The loop parameters,
sure.
Which are empirically determined and precise in the table.
Right.
You really have a full experimental set for the parameters for the small loops.
For the small loops.
For the large loops, yes. he is adding the entropy of the Gaussian.
Right. So in fact, for to be complete, in the actual code, I'm modeling even small loops as springs. So my model is really homogeneous.
I think we should
sort of
leave the discussion.
Yes.
On the
exactly.
Code and modeling.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's actually it's coming right now. So let me just finish this. So for instance, we here now, we just calculate everything again, which pick a new stem, this one, we're now here. Again, we have to calculate everything. So in fact, what usually happens is that starting from the denature sequence, you just collapse in some with many small helices. And at some point, well, there is basically no room to add any new stem on the sequence. And the, one of the most likely moves that you can make is actually unmake already formed stems. So for instance, here, we can decide to break, in fact, this stem. So we go here. Obviously, this conformation 4 is exactly the same as 2, but in between we have some estimate of the time. Okay, so okay, so this is typically what we do, and we just wander around in phase space. Okay, so let me show you some results. Okay. Right. Okay, so I guess I will probably skip this one. I will talk about folding path and kinetic regulation of the hepatitis delta virus ribozyme, which is the molecule I have most studied so far. So this molecule, so, you know, when we are discussing real biological system, you always have to tell a story, some background about this system. And this is, those are usually fascinating stories, and coming from physics, it's really fascinating. So in this case, this virus, it's a single-stranded RNA virus, which is actually circular, so we have a closed system like this. And in exception to what I think there was Professor Tinoco said yesterday, this single-stranded virus actually doesn't carry its own polymerase, the message for its own polymerase, and instead it seems to use the host's Pol2 polymerase to do its own replication. So this polymerase, in fact, dot presumably somewhere on the virus and start replicating it. So obviously, since you start from a circular object, you expect to form a long spaghetti if nothing happened. So obviously, at some point, you really have to have a pair of scissors that cut this this long spaghetti into unit length. Okay, and then obviously this is not finished. You need to ligate this unit length, after which you have not the initial virus but a mirror copy of it. Okay, so by miracle, this mirror copy can exactly do the same trick, that is, use Pol2 to replicate itself, although it doesn't code for any protein or whatsoever. It's just an intermediate. So it just, and Pol2 does the same trick, and the copy of the antigenomic virus has also obviously to cut itself and then be ligated. So what I've been interested in is in this cutting, cleaving aspect. So obviously you could expect some protein to be involved. There are always a protein to solve all sort of problems in a cell, but in that case, there is actually no protein. So this pair of scissors are why I was referring to is in fact encoded in the virus sequence itself. So there is in fact a small region on this virus which is about 2,000 bases long. There is a short region of about 80 bases long that is able to fold in some very condensed matter, and once folded in this conformation, it's able to cleave the upstream sequence, its own the sequence of the virus. So, and this has been very well studied by the biologists. So obviously, and as you saw, this molecule has pseudonauts. So since I wanted to include pseudonauts, that was obviously a good case to test the code. So when you take this short piece and you try to apply basically the algorithm I described earlier on, this is what you find. So here you have three energies in KT and time. So each dot on this transparency corresponds to the free energy of the structure adapted to the corresponding time. So as you can see, in fact, there is a rapid collapse on the axis. You can't actually see. And then what we do is we just go up and down, and we're populating clearly structures, different structures that we just visit again and again. Okay. Sometimes you see that you escape this region of structure space and go to another region, but then you might have to go back. Okay. So when you look at all these structures, especially the low free energy ones, and you compare to the known structure of the catalytic structure of this ribozyme, well, in fact, you're disappointed because none of it resemble whatsoever to the known molecule. So there is apparently a problem. So, okay, who knows? But if you can follow this dynamical system that is modeling your molecule for a long enough time, after several minutes, you have a transition after which you're basically in the correct structure, I mean the known catalytic structure. So that seems to say that probably the code is not so bad after all, but obviously this very long delay, you know, that is typically several minutes, is very puzzling, because you have to imagine that the virus, if it had to wait for several minutes for this region to fold correctly and then cleave, the polymerase would have generate kilometers of single strands that might do. Sorry, what? Yes. So here. Right. So that's just one event. So at some point you have the transition. This is one single run. So what I should that's a good point. What I should have said is that. When you do many runs, that's the typical scenario. So 70% of the time, that's what happened. You just collapse in some misfolded structure, and then you have to wait for a long time before you actually find the non-catalytic structure. But 30% of the time, you actually collapse directly in the right structure. So that's exactly the same type of what is it? What? All those? Here you mean? So as I said, those regions corresponds to the fact that the molecule is trying to escape, and it's just found some new local minimum where it's more or less trapped for several seconds. Typically, but as you can see, the bottom of the corner of phase space is actually higher than the one where it just came. So in fact, after some seconds, it will return to the original basin of attraction. Yeah, it's more diluted, which means that the combination of stamps is probably more restricted. Here also, as you can see, this. So. That's the only, yeah.
So the energy level are the possible states at each time that you're going to go back and forth?
Yes, yes, exactly. Okay, so, so obviously this very long delay for the virus to fold would seem to be a problem. But obviously, yes?
At the moment of
at that 10-minute mark where you get that transition.
Right.
Is there some, can you see exactly what the transition state is? Does it have to go into a very unlikely state in order to go there?
Yes. So that's exactly what happened. So you can trace. Really, you see that here, you cover almost 20 kT. I mean, you can see there are a few dots that are about 20 kT above, local ground state, which tells you that indeed there is a very high barrier. Okay, and you can precisely trace where things seems to change.
And is it always the same intermediate steps going from the initial state? In other words, you don't get those same.
Yeah, no, I see. I would be tempted to say yes, but I haven't looked at it carefully enough, so I can't really answer. Well, this pseudonoid, yes, but in fact, before you've got many pseudonoid structures. So, I mean, okay, pseudonauts have nothing special. They are all over the place. That's the message. So in fact, it is very costly. Maybe I'll come back to that after the break. So the virus, obviously doesn't do that. It doesn't denature its own sequence and then refold it. In fact, it can't help having it fold while it's synthesized. It's a couple of minutes. Yeah, so that's, I mean, I looked at that, that's, I mean, the distribution is more or less exponential, so as one would expect with a very high barrier, and the mean is typically 1 or 2 minutes. Okay, so presumably what the virus does is having its sequence folded while it's being synthesized. So this we can easily model. We just have to add new bases because we have this time parameter in the code. We can add new bases as a given rate. So, and we can obviously vary the rate also. So when we do that, what we find is that now almost 90% of the runs will lead you directly to the correct ground state, the correct catalytic structure by the end of synthesis. Okay, so you went from only 30% that were collapsing directly in the quench scenario to 90% also folding correctly while it's being synthesized. So obviously, I mean, that suggests, I think, that the code of this sequence codes not only for the final structure, but also for an efficient folding path in the context of replication. And so this is exactly what I want you to look at. So what you can do is you can do a blow up on the region corresponding to the synthesis, and one scenario again will look a bit like that, but in fact they all superpose onto this one. So what you have is the folding path during synthesis is made of very well defined steps, and those steps corresponds to very stable intermediates, and those intermediates are stable because they involve strong stems. So some of those stems are some of the native stems that you will eventually get by the end of synthesis, so P1 to P4, but some other stems like P5 or P8 are very strong transient stems that essentially seems to guide the sequence into the right structure. Yes. So there is a uniform, I mean, there is a constant rate of synthesis, which is not the case in real RNA molecules. We know that there are post sites and things like that. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. Right. So so in fact, when you change rate, the you basically have the same folding scenario, but the you vary slightly the number of good folders. Okay, but in fact, it's you vary only very slightly this this fraction, which is also so typically if you fold at 10 times faster, you go from 90% good folders to maybe 70% good folders. So there seems to be a relatively weak effect on the polymerase rate, which also, coming back to these post sites, maybe those post sites might not be too important for the folding scenario. That is, in fact, the actual rate at which you synthesize the sequence doesn't seem to matter too much. But, I mean, again, we should certainly keep that in mind. Okay. So, again, those were folding scenarios, single folding scenarios. So, in order to say something robust, we really have to do many of those. And basically, what we have to do is to do folding path statistics. So, when you do that, you find something which is, in fact, relatively simple. What we find is that there is dynamic bifurcation between essentially two folding paths, with the bifurcation occurring rather early on during the synthesis of this molecule. So in the majority of cases, you at this stage, so when you have synthesized about 40 bases, you form P1 and P5, whereas in about 10% of cases, you will form alternative stems, P6 and P7, that are very strong as well. And the important result is that once this bifurcation has been passed, the fate of the structure is sealed. I mean, the molecule will either be 100% of the time, end up 100% of the time in the active conformation when it has chosen the right pathway, whereas if it just happened to have formed those two stems earlier on, then it's bound to be misfolded by the end of synthesis. And from here, from this misfolded state, again, you has to wait for typically a few minutes before finding the catalytic structure. So what was puzzling at first here was that in order to have some very efficient guiding of the sequence towards the native state, the system seems to use wrong stems, that is, non-native stems like P5 or P8. Okay? So naively, one would expect that, you know, using wrong stems will likely lead you to traps from which you have a hard time to escape. But that's in fact not the case. And in this example, we can understand why. So imagine you have synthesized, so the sequence has been synthesized up to up to about 60. So now you have this very stable structure. So this is very stable because you have two very strong stems, P1 and P8. If you stop here, nothing really can happen to this structure. So now, by just adding a few bases downstream of the chain, you see that at some point you can nucleate a new region. And once you do that, in fact, you can essentially exchange the stability of P8 by some zipping mechanism like this. So P8, that was extremely stable before, is in fact rather easily displaced by the extension of a new downstream stem that is P4, in fact. So in this respect, that means that P8 really act as a folding guide for the sequence. And in fact, we realize that this is, for the actual virus, this is in fact very important to have this catalytic activity, this self-cleavage activity, as soon as it's been synthesized. Because now, if we add, you know, if we go on synthesizing the chain beyond the actual ribozyme, well, what happens is that very soon afterwards, you develop cross-hybridization between the new downstream chain in blue here and the few remaining single-strand region of the ribozyme. And this presumably, although it doesn't break the native stem of the ribozyme first, is already likely to stop any sort of catalytic activity for this domain. And that's occur very fast, as soon as the new chain is here. So once you're here, in fact, this is not the end, and there is a rather slow rearrangement of this region into a very stable, almost perfectly complementary long cigar like this, where the ribozyme in black here is completely unfolded and paired with this downstream region. So you see that if, for some reason, you haven't found the right catalytic structure by the end of synthesis, in fact, the same sort of regulation of the activity will occur, which means that once you've developed those cross-hybridization, there is no way you can hope to have any sort of catalytic activity later on, because you know that you're really driven down toward this very stable, non-active conformation. So although I haven't touched on the project, shall I stop here and we can have...
Well, I mean, it's even 10 minutes.
Ah, okay. So I can... Do you want me to go on? So I can go on.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
I actually have a question for Gary. The question is that I can imagine if you have these necessary intermediate non-native contacts, so that would make the phylogenetic analysis, the results of the phylogenetic analysis, rather interesting. You know, that you would get sort of phylogenetic pairing between contacts that do not appear in the final structure.
Put it back.
There are not seems to be the deciding factors, so if you destabilize P5, you should change it.
Okay, so maybe let me return to that. Okay. So indeed, you can see that the same region, so from here to here, here to here, can adopt very different structures, okay? and obviously, one can hope to modify this dynamic bifurcation by, you know, adding a few mismatches, either favoring this path with respect to this one or the other way around. So that we can obviously do. And in particular, what we have checked is that so that was also done in experiments. So, oops. You see, okay, so the P5 region corresponds to this hybridization in this domain. And you see that obviously this is competing with P3, which is on the native structure. So what some experimenters have done is changing base pairs in P3 that should not affect P3 too much. In fact, you can, for instance, if you swap G and C here in the middle, you actually don't change the native structure at all. but obviously, you're now adding mismatches in P5. Okay. So when you do that, in fact, experimentally, it's known that you unfavor rapid folding, and this I could really check. On the other hand, you can now you see in this region, if you make a mismatch here that doesn't affect this intermediate, you can in fact almost distinguish this misfolding path. So that I can do. I can do mutation, point mutation, I mean complementary mutation, or point mutation, I don't remember in fact, but you can do mutations that will essentially lead to 100% good folders in this system. Yes?
I have a question to the lone complementary, almost complementary
yes.
region.
Yes.
Is this the ribozyme on the complementary strand? Because it can't be an accident such a long complementary.
Right, so that's exactly that.
The ribozyme.
Yes.
And there are a few differences in the sequence.
Yes.
So the last strand ribozyme is a little different.
Exactly.
So this gives you the long complementary, the long.
Exactly. But it adopts a very similar structure, though. I mean, the antigenomic sequence.
But
okay, so that I don't remember it precisely. Let me put it back, yes. So offset by how much do you remember?
I'm sorry, I don't know. What my recollection was that they were not in fact, it was not the complementary strand that were forming the ribozymes, it was two different.
Okay. In my recollection, that was almost the same thing. Okay. Okay. But I mean, roughly speaking, I think this is exactly the picture. Yes.
So this long complementary region is then on the 3' end of the minus strand. If this is the plus strand.
Right.
And that should form the ribozyme for the other.
Yes. Yes. And that's what happens. Well, that's what I.
You don't believe?
My recollection is different.
I mean, it's probably it is offset because the other ribozyme doesn't have exactly the same length, and you can, but it certainly have a very similar structure.
So they definitely have a similar structure.
Yeah.
But if this would not be the case, I wouldn't understand why the virus couldn't have mutations in there.
Right. Right.
Problem.
Right.
It can't be an accident. You have such a long sequence.
So the whole genome actually makes this kind of rather structure. Yeah. There may be everything in the based pair neurons, both in terms of stability and in terms of transcription.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So, and then it could be even that there is some advantage that we might appreciate to the attenuation of the cleavage.
Well, that's what I was describing. Basically, once you've cleaved, so you want it to be very efficient during transcription, but then you want to regulate this down because you don't want your circular virus to be cleaved, to cleave itself all the time. So you really have, so basically...
Is this the folding for the circular virus?
Yes. Yes. Right. So basically, for the virus, you have a very short window of time during which it has to cleave. Because after that, the cleavage is essentially impossible. It's regulated down by the sequence, by the hybridization of the sequence itself. Maybe we have tea. Yeah.
Some tea, so we meet here at a quarter to four again.
Sorry, what?
A quarter to four.
Okay.